From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a singer-songwriter who's been described as the ambassador of the underworld, we meet Nick Cave. He's performing on the Lollapalooza tour, alternative rock and hip-hop's biggest traveling show. Also, even if you've seen all the movies about Al Capone, Lawrence Berggren says you don't know the real story. Berggren tells us about his new biography, which challenges a lot of assumptions about the notorious gangster. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell has proposed another health care reform plan. It's more conservative than the president's proposal, and it takes longer to phase in. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports.
Mitchell bases his plan on the voluntary purchase of insurance by people who don't get insurance at work. He says it will cover just about everybody by making insurance cheaper and easier to get.
I am confident that its provisions will assure that 95% of all Americans will be covered by guaranteed, portable, renewable insurance over the course of the next 6 years.
In case this does not work by then, Mitchell would make employers pay for half the insurance of workers. Most Senate Democrats accept Mitchell's plan. Most Republicans don't. The House is expected to pass a more liberal plan. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The Senate Banking Committee continues its Whitewater hearings, and Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman, who's before them, is apologizing to the committee. He says he's sorry if any of his previous statements misled them. He had earlier told the group he'd only one contact with the White House over the probe on a failed Arkansas savings and loan with ties to President and Mrs. Clinton. In fact, there have been about 40 contacts. Altman says he either forgot or he may have misunderstood senators' questions. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says that Zairean soldiers at the Goma airport are stealing, at gunpoint, relief supplies intended for Rwandan refugees. A relief spokesman says the agency has asked the local Zairean governor to stop this. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Goma, Zaire.
Although more relief planes are coming into the Goma airport every day, the million-plus Rwandan refugees near here are still getting only a fraction of what they need. And now, says UNHCR spokesman Panos Momses, Zairean soldiers are taking some of the precious relief cargo as soon as it arrives at the Goma airport.
They've been going to aid workers who are offloading the plane and taking food or packages away. And when we stopped and said, sorry, it's not for you, it's not road for the soldiers, they turned the gun to the side and said, are you sure you don't want me to take it?
UNHCR has asked the local governor to stop this brazen armed robbery before it gets any more out of hand. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Goma, Zaire.
A published report says the Irish Republican Army could announce a temporary ceasefire. The Irish Times says the information comes from pro-IRA sources in Belfast. The newspaper quotes the sources as saying a unilateral suspension of IRA violence will probably start in September. It could last between 1 and 3 months. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down a point and a half at 3,796. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq has fallen a fraction to 724. This is NPR. The Department of Housing and Urban Development will be working with 6 large pension funds to create and fix up rental housing in 20 communities. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Under the initiative, 6 pension funds, including the California Public Employees Retirement System and the Board of Pensions and Retirement of Philadelphia, are investing their money in low- and middle-income rental housing. In return, HUD will give them rent subsidies to help guarantee that a project will remain rented for at least 5 years. Critics of the idea say the retirees in these funds will receive a lower rate of return on their investments, but Cisneros argues that HUD projects are viable investment options.
Because of the federal support, returns can be structured in a way that they are superior to what a pension fund might get, for example, investing the same money in bonds. They are superior from an investment standpoint and equally safe.
The pension fund investment should begin actually producing new housing in about a year and a half. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A special science panel is hearing arguments on regulating nicotine as a drug. An advisory committee for the Food and Drug Administration is questioning scientists in a Washington suburb about smoking. Government experts say the number of people who try and can't quit smoking is evidence of how addictive nicotine is. But only a little more than a million people succeed in kicking the habit each year. Tobacco firms say smoking is a free choice, and it's one the government shouldn't block. Serbia has delivered a strongly worded letter to the Bosnian Serbs today. It rebukes them for failing to accept the international peace plan for Bosnia. President Slobodan Milosevic says the Bosnian Serbs will be committing treason and crimes against their own people if they go on rejecting the plan. The letter also says the Bosnian Serb leaders are endangering their relationship with Serbia if they go on being stubborn. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Lollapalooza Tour is the big summer concert event for alternative rock and hip-hop. My guest Nick Cave is one of the featured performers. Although he started recording nearly 15 years ago, his music is a well-kept secret, even to many of the music fans who come to Lollapalooza. His work is better known in England, where one journalist described him as the ambassador of the underworld. In Rolling Stone, he was described as recording some of the most disturbing and brutally compelling music of the post-punk era. His music has been featured in two Wim Wenders films. Cave co-starred in the film Johnny Suede. He was born in a small Australian town in 1957 and moved to England in 1980. Cave and his band The Bad Seeds have a new CD called Let Love In. Cave is featured on piano and organ, sings lead, and wrote the songs. This is Do You Love Me?
I found her on the night of fire and noise. Wild bells rang in a wild sky. I knew from that moment on that I'd love her till the day that I died. And I kissed away a thousand tears, my lady of the various sorrows. Some begged, some borrowed, some stolen, some kept safe tomorrow. On an endless night, silver star spangled, the bells from the chapel went jingle, jingle.
Do you love me?
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 I really like this song, and much as I like the song, I listen to the song and I say, gee, I wouldn't want to be involved in a relationship with a man like that.
Well, I tend to write songs in certain moods, and I tend to write things when I am frustrated and disgusted with things, and I don't know, it just sort of seems to all come pouring out when I feel that way. So unfortunately, a lot of the people around me don't get off too well in a lot of my songs, or come out of my songs quite badly. This isn't really to suggest that I have a kind of completely dysfunctional kind of relationship with everybody around me. It's just that I write a lot out of anger and frustration. In that particular song, I was trying to show. I thought in perhaps a little heavy-handed way at times, but that there's sort of two sides to everybody, and most of the lines mirror each other. There's a line of adoration, and then there's the reverse side of the coin.
Do you think of love as being filled with terrors?
I think it has the potential to be that way. Yeah, definitely.
Now, there's two different songs called Do You Love Me on the album, and the album opens with one of the Do You Love Me's and closes with another. The ending version is about a boy who's sexually molested in a movie theater. Tell me about rewriting the song, about writing it two different ways.
Well, basically, it was just one very long song that I'd written, that I'd been writing for months and months and months, and it's a typical thing that happens with me. I just kind of keep building and building and building on a song. And very often I find that I've written too much to sort of comfortably contain in one song. And usually I have to kind of edit it drastically. I mean, a lot of my songs, they're four verses long, but in fact, there's 20 verses being written or something like that. Quite a great deal of them. But this song I was particularly fond of. I wanted to describe a person's initiation into the kind of rites of love as a child, and the intensity of that initiation, and then kind of write a song about the reverberations of that, in the sense that it can lead to dysfunctional adult relationships. This is sounding like Oprah Winfrey or something. Like that. But anyway, that's basically what I was trying to do. And in the end, I just couldn't contain it in one song. It was all too much and too clumsy. So I chopped it in half and threw out a lot of verses and turned it into two different songs.
I like one of the lines here about the older man's breath smelling like death and vanilla. Was he? Do you imagine him like eating something vanilla in it in the movie theater?
Well, I mean, vanilla—the smell of vanilla—always seemed to me like the smell of semen. And and at the same time, to me, the smell of death is something sweet. Anyway, I don't know, sweet and rotten kind of thing. And vanilla rhymes very well with, what is it, killer or gorilla? I don't know.
I think it's killer.
Something like that. But yeah, I mean, that's where that came from. I just thought vanilla, I don't know, vanilla seems to me to be something kind of nasty about that. I don't know.
See, and I like vanilla so much, so I'm thinking, it must have been a wholesome snack from the candy counter.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, let me play this second version of Do You Love Me? It's on my guest Nick Cave's new album, Let Love In.
There's a man in the theater with girlish eyes. He's holding my childhood to ransom. On the screen there's a death, there's a rustle of cloth, and a sickly voice calling me handsome. There's a man in the theater with sly girlish eyes. On the screen there's a neat big gorilla. There's a groan, there's a cough, there's a rustle of cloth, and a voice that stinks of death and vanilla. This is a secret, mauled and mangled, and the coins in my pocket go jingle, jangle.
That's Nick Cave from his new album, Let Love In. Now, you're on the Lollapalooza tour now, which is the big tour of alternative rock and hip-hop. What role do you feel you've been cast in on this tour? Do you feel like your presence signifies something?
Oh, I don't know. I think that we're kind of something like the geeks on this tour. I mean, if if it's some sort of circus, then you've got your high flyers and the people are putting their heads in the lion's mouths and stuff like that. But we seem to be kind of put over in some wire cage, with chicken blood running down our chins or something like that. I mean, I think that we're considered as this kind of oddball group who are on the bill, and I don't feel that we're really relating very well to what the kids consider to be alternative and so on.
So how does that affect what you play and how you play it?
I mean, it took us a while to get over that, actually. We were very depressed about the whole thing for the first week or so until we kind of turned it around. Now we just sort of disregard the kind of circumstances of the whole thing and just go on and explode for half an hour and go off again and hope something sort of sticks. I mean, it's just too long a tour to kind of sort of be miserable about, in a way. I mean, I think we're getting a very positive response from people now, simply because we are putting more energy into what we're doing.
How well do you relate to the other performers on the tour and their music?
We get on with them all in different ways. I mean, you know, they're all kind of different. I mean, one of the good things about the Lollapalooza thing is that there are a lot of very different sorts of groups, and And as much as it's an eye-opener for the kids, it's also an eye-opener for some of the musicians, I think. So, I mean, you've got George Clinton's band standing on the side of stage watching our group sort of day after day, and the same with us, which is something that would never happen, really, I think, you know, in any other situation. So that's very interesting.
Has George Clinton offered any interesting observations about your music?
Well, we get extreme encouragement from the guys from George Clinton's band. They're always they seem to love what we do. There was actually a moment when his band didn't turn up, and he was had 2 minutes to go on or something like that, and he asked the Bad Seeds if they'd go up and sort of back him. And, you know, basically just sort of went, well, all you go is funk, and then go boom, 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 funk, boom. And that was basically our instructions. But in the end, the band arrived at the 11th hour, and we missed our opportunity. But yeah, I mean, things like that are possible on the Lollapalooza thing, and that makes things quite exciting. I mean, more and more actually, bands are getting up with each other, and the kind of seriousness of the whole thing is being lifted with each. You know, with each kind of concert.
Nick Cave is my guest. He has a new CD called Let Love In. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nick Cave. Now, your earlier band, The Birthday Party, I've never seen the band and have only heard a little bit of Birthday Party's recorded music, but you told one interviewer, we had no interest in shocking people with the band. We wanted to go out and really abuse people and assault them and hurt them. What were you doing in that band?
Physically? We were physically assaulting the audience. I don't know. You know, hitting them over the head with microphone stands and throwing fold-back wedges on them and, I don't know, stuff like that.
What the heck for?
I don't know. It got us in the newspapers pretty quickly.
Is that why you were doing it?
No, I mean, the reason why we were doing it was that we'd come from Australia as managed to get tickets out of Australia. Someone bought us tickets out of Australia, and so we decided to keep the band together because they thought that we had some kind of talent. Went over to England with the expectations that it was going to be this wonderful place with thousands of wonderful groups playing and this big scene going on there and so forth. We found out that it was nothing of the sort, that it was a nasty kind of constipated society. We lived there without any money whatsoever. We were treated like complete aliens. The fact that we're an Australian group we were kind of the local joke in that respect, there was an Australian group trying to do something. And gradually we became more and more disappointed, embittered and frustrated towards that country. And I think that that's really what the kind of heart of the kind of nasty, twisted little heart that the Birthday Party had, that's where it came from. So basically we got up on stage and vented our frustration.
How did it feel to do that? Was that an emotional release for you? Did it feel good?
It felt good, yeah. It's great to have a license to be able to do that sort of thing.
Why would people come to be abused by you?
Oh, they do. They love that. The problem was that after a while they came and demanded that we be that way, and that was never what we wanted. We were that way because we were sincerely angry about things. When it became a kind of sort of a sideshow thing where we were expected to do those things. We just broke up because it didn't seem to work for us anymore.
It sounds like there was a period of your life when not only was your band abusive on stage, but you were kind of self-abusive in a way. You were doing a lot of heroin for a while, if you don't mind me mentioning that. It's kind of public record now, so to speak. I guess I'm wondering, just knowing how depressive so many of your songs are, if you think they became more so under the influence of heroin.
I don't think that they are particularly depressive, really. I just think...
Lyrically?
I think they're quite brutal lyrically, but I think that personally, I think hopefully there appears to be a great joy in the actual use of language in my songs, and that when I'm writing these songs, I'm obviously having a good time about it as well. There's a certain amount of enjoyment that should come across in the way I write. So I don't really think that they're depressive. And in terms of taking a lot of drugs, I mean, I just took a lot of drugs. It's very difficult for me to know one way or the other whether what the songs would have been like without them or not, you know. I basically stopped because I was busted so many times that it was either going to a clinic or going to prison. And so I went to the clinic, and in the end, I was forced to stop for a while, but when I came out, decided that, all right, I've stopped. Let's try and remain that way.
So how did it change your life to stop?
Well, I mean, once I came out of the clinic, I watched TV non-stop for about a year. I hardly left my house.
Why didn't you leave your house?
Well, because I really couldn't cope with things very well. I went to into a clinic and was kind of spat out the other side, drugless, but without any preparation for a world, in that state, and that was very difficult for me. But, you know, gradually things things are okay, you know. I'm functioning. I function.
You mentioned the kind of joy in language in your writing. I thought I'd play something that's actually, I think, very funny from the new record, and this is called Lay Me Low. And I think everybody plays the game of fantasizing what people will say about them after they die, what their funeral would be like, and this song kind of picks up on that fantasy in a pretty funny way. Would you say anything about writing it?
Well, I would say that it's this is another song that was endless in the sense that there was there was 40 verses or something to this song, and it's one of those songs that I really love to write in the sense that they can be just kind of built on and built on and built on, and then you sort of have to just edit it all down. But yeah, it's basically a comic song about my demise, and it's supposed to be seen in that way, you know.
And it's all about what your family will say and friends will say and what the press will say and how they'll see your work in a different light.
Yes.
So this is Lay Me Low from Nick Cave's new album.
Hats off to the man on top of the world. Come crawl up here, baby, and I'll show you how it works. If you wanna be my friend and you wanna repent and you want it all to end and you wanna know when, well, do it now, don't care how. Take your final bow, make a stand, take my hand and blow it all. Breathe a sigh of relief. He'll say, "As I'm a lander and a bad lander and a thief." Yeah, when I go up, they'll interview my teachers. Who'll say I was one of God's sorry creatures. They'll print informative six-page features. When I go, they'll bang a big old gun.
When did you write that song?
I wrote it, last year, I think.
Have you ever come really close to death?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, have you?
No.
No. Okay. Well, I mean, anyone who takes a lot of drugs, anyone who takes a lot of heroin, I guess has. I mean, I have.
So you're married now, and you're a father.
Yeah, more or less.
More or less.
Well, I'm
married,
not exactly married, but might as well be.
Are there certain moods or really dark feelings that you feel as a father you have to protect your child from, even though those feelings are such an important part of who you are?
That I have to protect him from myself.
Or just from even, you know, from thinking those kinds of thoughts.
I don't, you know, I mean...
The kind of stuff that you might bring out in your art might not be the kind of stuff you want to... emphasize around.
You know, I don't think that my feelings about things are any different really than other people's. I just think that I have the ability to articulate them. You know, I don't really think that I need that. You know, I think my son's going to have these feelings no matter what. You know, I mean, basically, I think what I'm trying to talk about is loss, a loss of things. I think that that's what's the main theme that runs through my music is a sense of kind of indescribable loss of things, and I think everyone feels that, but I just tend to write about it a lot.
Well, speaking of loss, one of the songs on your new album, She's Nobody's Baby Now, is about a lover who's died. At least that's how I hear it. I don't know if that's
what it's about. It's about a lover that's gone away, okay. Not necessarily died. Yeah, but I mean, that's basically one of the kind of nails I've been bang away on for years, really.
Well, why is that?
Well, because I mean, I feel that sensation very strongly. I feel a mood that I get in, which is a kind of melancholy mood that I get in, but really has something to do with loss. I don't know how to really explain. There's a Brazilian word for it, saudade, which is kind of like an indescribable, undefinable sensation of loss, and that's basically what I'm trying to write about.
Why don't we hear She's Nobody's Baby Now?
Yeah, that's a good song.
I loved her then, and I guess I love her still. Hers is the face I see when a certain mood moves in. She lives in my blood and skin. A wild feral stare, her dark hair, her winter lips as cold as stone. Things love won't allow. I held her hand, but I don't hold it now. I don't know why and I don't know how, but she's nobody's baby now. Now this is her dress that I loved best, the blue quilted violets across the breast. And these are my many letters, torn to pieces by long fingered.
Nick Cave. He's currently performing on the Lollapalooza tour. His new CD is called Let Love In. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Public Enemy Number One. We talk with Lawrence Berggren about his new biography of Al Capone. Berggren says the Capone we think we know is a myth created by the yellow journalism of the 1920s, Hollywood sensationalism, and anti-Italian prejudice. The story of Al Capone and crime in the Prohibition era coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell has unveiled a new health care reform proposal. Mitchell says his compromise plan draws upon ones produced earlier by the Senate Finance and Labor Committees.
What I am proposing is to have a voluntary system which includes insurance market reform, subsidies for the uninsured, and voluntary purchasing cooperatives. I believe, and the preliminary estimate of the Congressional Budget Office is, that such a voluntary system will provide coverage to 95% of all Americans by the year 2000.
If that level of coverage isn't reached, Mitchell's plan calls for employers and employees to split the cost of coverage 50-50. U.S. Marines are on the hills in Washington state today battling fires. They are mopping up behind civilian crews who are trying to keep the flames from spreading in the Cascade Mountains. About 1,000 Army soldiers will also join firefighters tomorrow in Idaho and Montana. They're expected on the job after training in Texas. Idaho officials are reporting some success. They say two fires along the border with Utah have now been contained. They were among dozens of fires touched off by weekend lightning storms. Thunderstorms in Utah ignited more than 220 fires in the past week. More than 150,000 acres were scorched before the blazes were controlled. Missouri, Michigan, and Kansas are holding primary elections today. Candidates are vying for the right to replace two retiring senators and a retiring governor. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
In Missouri, more than a dozen people are vying to take the place of retiring Republican Senator John Danforth. Six-term Congressman Alan Wheat is the Democratic frontrunner. He's expected to be the first African-American to win a major party's nomination for statewide office in Missouri. Former Governor John Ashcroft leads the Republicans. The Kansas governor's race is led by Democratic Congressman Jim Slattery. The Republican nomination will likely go to Kansas Secretary of State Bill Graves or a wealthy entrepreneur named Gene Bicknell. Governor Joan Finney threw open the race when she decided not to seek a second term. And in Michigan, six Democrats and two Republicans are competing for the seat left open by retiring Democratic Senator Donald Riegel. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
The government says sales of new homes dropped more than 14% in June to their lowest level in 2 years. The Commerce Department says all regions of the country were down. Analysts say home buyers are being scared off because of rising interest rates, and there are indications that sales fell even more in July. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 2 points to end at 3,796. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. A South Korean government newspaper says North Korea will demand a new nuclear reactor during talks with the United States. The report says this will be the price for opening its nuclear program to inspectors. The official paper says the North will also seek full diplomatic ties with the United States as part of a package deal. The U.S. response will reportedly show if Washington is really interested in a solution to the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula. The paper says U.S. officials reportedly want a step-by-step approach that rewards the North as progress is made on the nuclear issue. Representatives of more than 40 governments are attending a pledging conference in Geneva. The United Nations is asking for more than $450 million to cover its relief work in Rwanda for the rest of the year. Sophie Fisher of the BBC reports.
UN aid officials say the appeal response has been very good. But what has really pleased the organisers of this conference is that the governments have backed the UN's political strategy for tackling the crisis. This strategy shifts the emphasis away from food aid to confidence building. The UN's concerned that unless they can make people feel secure, a million more Rwandans might flee the country, and those already in Zaire will not start to return. But the UN's top emergency relief coordinator, Peter Hansen, warned that time was very short.
There's clearly a correlation between the speed of our response and the containment of the emergency. It is not too late to speak of prevention.
The exact amount raised by this conference may not be clear for some time, but what is clear is that the speed with which the pledges come in will largely determine what happens next in the Rwanda crisis.
Sophie Fisher reporting. Searchers are still looking for a missing Utah Highway Patrol helicopter pilot. Sergeant Doyle Thorne disappeared Saturday night while on a flight. There is no sign of him or his helicopter. Hundreds of people are searching for him on foot. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Capone was public enemy number one in the Prohibition era, and he's still the subject of American fascination. Robert De Niro played him in the 1987 film The Untouchables. Now William Forsythe is Capone in the syndicated Untouchables TV series. My guest Lawrence Berggren has written a new biography of Capone. He says he's never written about someone whose real life differed so sharply from his reputation. Berggren is also the author of biographies of songwriter Irving Berlin and writer James Agee. He says the Capone myth was created by the yellow journalism of the 20s, Hollywood sensationalism, and anti-Italian prejudice. Berggren concludes that the lawmen who were after Capone were hypocritical and self-serving. They used Capone as a scapegoat for the failure of Prohibition.
Al Capone was not a super criminal. He was a racketeer. If it hadn't been for Prohibition, which began in 1920, he would have been a minor hoodlum and remained in Brooklyn, and where he was born, and nobody ever would have heard of him. Keep in mind that when Capone began his career, he was first an accountant for a legitimate construction company in Baltimore, and he only left that job, at which he was doing quite well, with the beginning of Prohibition and when his mentor, Johnny Torrio, who was sort of the godfather of modern crime, invited him to come to Chicago to take advantage of some of the opportunities there. And if Prohibition had ended 5 years earlier, Capone would have been remembered only as a sometime gambler and small-time pimp. So the legends about Capone, the apocryphal stories, wound up supplanting the truth about him. In the case of his older brother, who was supposed to be a lawman and a Prohibition agent, I thought those stories were apocryphal. As my research continued, I discovered they were in fact true, and there was more to them than anybody suspected. So that's what made the research for this book so interesting and paradoxical.
Yeah, Capone's older brother, who went by the name Richard Two Gun Hart because he didn't want to use his name Capone, was a marshal. He was a Prohibition agent.
That's right. I became fascinated by the Capone family, which consisted of eight boys and a girl, as a whole, because there were so many varied personalities. You had Al, who was in the middle chronologically, and we know about him. But then his oldest brother, who was named Vincenzo, ran away from home, which was Brooklyn. Served in the First World War, was a sharpshooter, changed his name to Richard Hart because he admired William S. Hart, the silent movie cowboy, and sort of lost himself in this assumed identity in the Midwest in Nebraska. Was the first Capone to become famous and notorious as a very violent lawman who was enforcing Prohibition. In fact, he killed more people in the line of duty than Capone did as a gangster, as an outlaw. And his older brother, Two Gun Hart, became so unpopular at one point that he was almost lynched by a mob after he had shot a suspected bootlegger.
Did anyone in the government know that Two Gun Hart was really Vincenzo Capone?
No. And in fact, he was even a bodyguard for President Calvin Coolidge one summer under his assumed name, and nobody realized it. Imagine if a brother of John Gotti was a bodyguard for the president today. That would be an analogous situation.
Well, there's another way in which you would like to revise popular history. You say that a lot of Elliot Ness's image is based on half-truths, that that he bungled a lot of things. He was a publicity hound. He was an alcoholic.
That's right. Like many people, my impressions of Ness had been conditioned by years of watching movies and television. I discovered that the real Ness had very little to do with bringing down Capone. He was insignificant in that entire process. In fact, Capone was jailed for income tax evasion and not for bootleg violations. However, Ness made, Al Capone was the greatest thing that ever happened to Elliot Ness, who made a career on boasting, often erroneously, that he was responsible for getting Capone. And when he wrote with a collaborator his book, The Untouchables, this book included many fictionalized episodes of encounters between the two, encounters that never happened and which glorified Ness's role. That book was published a year or two after Ness died, so he was never able to entirely enjoy the fruits of the posthumous fame that it conferred on him.
How close did Ness get to actually catching Capone?
Well, he never got close at all. They once talked on a train after Capone was about to be dragged away to jail, but they never met face-to-face, and all the bootlegging violations, the indictments that Ness rounded up, were thrown out. They were never used in court. So he really didn't get very close. It was the IRS, the taxmen, who really came much closer.
What was Chicago crime like when Al Capone came there in the early 1920s working for his mentor, Johnny Torrio?
Well, Chicago had a reputation as the ultimate boom town at that time. It had grown unbelievably quickly. It was Carl Sandburg's Chicago. It was brawling and lusty and big-shouldered and all of that. There was a Victorian type of crime. There were some brothels. They weren't particularly organized. There was the rudiment of an organized pimps association. Once Torrio came in, they very quickly carved up the territory, organized it. They combined brothels, gambling, and bootlegging, usually in the same establishment. Typically, the bar, the saloon would be on the ground floor, the gambling would be one floor up, and the brothel would be one floor above that. So that was the trinity of vice that Johnny Torrio, who was a generation older than Capone, put together. Torrio gave Capone control of this empire after he decided he was too old and this was too dangerous a way to live. So by the time Capone was 26 or 27, he took over the fastest growing vice empire in the country.
And how did he change it when he took it over in 1925?
Well, he came in with his family, which made a difference. It wasn't just one person. There was another brother named Frank, and there was another older brother named Ralph, often went by the name of Bottles Capone. And they organized it further. They continued to extend the territory. They were very good entrepreneurs. They also built strong connections to the city's civic establishment, to the politicians. This meant bribes. This meant supplying booze to everybody who wanted it. And this meant becoming very close with the newspapers and the newsrooms. Bribing reporters in those days was very common. So, and they gave news conferences all the time. So there was nothing particularly shadowy or furtive about their activities. By today's standards, they were extremely bold and extremely public.
Were they public about their vice? Public about the vice operations that they ran, the rackets?
They were public about the gambling, and they were public about the bootlegging. In fact, they advertised it. They were not at all public about the vice for obvious reasons, but they were willing to. But everybody knew. And one of the sources of Capone's strength within the rackets was his willingness to function as a pimp. Other racketeers avoided it. They considered it an infamy and wouldn't get anywhere near it. But Capone was up to his arms in it. And that was the worst insult anybody could hurl at Capone, was the word pimp. And I think because it was true.
My guest is Lawrence Berggren, has written a new biography of Al Capone. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Al Capone with biographer Lawrence Berggren. You said that Capone drew strength from the hypocrisy of the political establishment, particularly the hypocrisy around prohibition. Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, Capone was a gregarious person. He was in many ways a generous person. He gave away a fortune. He gave away many fortunes to the poor and the indigent in Chicago, and especially when the Depression hit and there were very few social services at that time. Capone filled a role as a de facto employment agency, and for thousands of Chicago citizens, especially Italians, he gave them jobs as truck drivers, or he gave them money to use or not use their garages. He was also impulsively generous in many ways. In the book, I tell the story of the great jazz bassist Milt Hinton, who, while he was struggling as a teenager in Chicago to get established, worked as a sometime bootlegger, a bootlegger delivery boy in Chicago, and was involved in a serious car accident, and he went flying through the windshield of his car, landed on the pavement, and when he came to, he realized that his finger was dangling, one of his fingers was dangling by a thread. He went to a hospital, and the doctor was going to amputate it. Once Capone got word that one of his bootleggers, even a very minor figure, was having this problem, he got a hold of Hinton's mother and went with her down to the hospital and ordered the doctor to sew the finger back rather than amputating it. Of course, when Al Capone told you to do something, you did it. So the doctor did that, and as Hinton later told me, the finger was sewn on a little crooked, but it worked just fine. And he went on to become one of the most recorded musicians of all time.
Why is it that the government could only get Capone on taxes? Why is he so hard to get any other way if he's running so many rackets?
Well, it was a question of what you could get a jury to convict him on. And there were three choices. The first, the most obvious, was violations of prohibition of the Volstead Act. However, that would be hard to get a jury to do because most jurors applauded for Capone for doing that. The second way would be murder charges. And now at that time, murder charges were almost always state charges, not federal charges. And they also printed the names, addresses, and photographs of jurors in the newspapers. Therefore, if a gangster were being tried for murder, and it often happened in Chicago, the first thing that his cronies did was go after the jurors, and they would either bribe them or intimidate them into acquitting. And that happened all the time. So that wasn't practical. That left the rather new alternative of trying Capone for income tax evasion. It was only in 1927 when the federal court, when the Supreme Court reinterpreted the tax laws and decided that you could do this, that undeclared income, you had to pay income tax on undeclared income, i.e. bootlegging and illegal income, as well as legal income, that the government had the power to do this. Now, that was rather dry and technical and sort of abstract, and that lent itself well to a jury trial because it didn't seem like there was much at stake.
My guest is Lawrence Berggren. He's written a new biography of Al Capone. We'll continue our conversation in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on about Rwanda?
Well, we'll be hearing reports of looting in Zaire today by soldiers there of supplies that are intended for the refugees from Rwanda. Also, the story of one Rwandan refugee, a teacher, and the decisions that that person makes about returning or not returning home. Also on today's program, we'll be talking with New York Times reporter Roger Cohn about his series on a death camp in Bosnia, where Bosnian Serbs executed many Bosnian Muslims, and to talk with Professor Easley Blackwood about his compositions for microtunings.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're talking about Al Capone with biographer Lawrence Berggren. It was when Capone was in prison that he was diagnosed with a mental deterioration resulting from syphilis, which he had contracted as a younger man, which he thought that he had healed from after the sores went away. And I want you to talk about this a little bit because you think of this syphilis as being key to understanding Capone's whole character.
Yes, I felt it was. Under the Freedom of Information Act, I obtained extensive medical and psychological records on Capone that were kept after he went to prison. In various files, there's a Federal Prison Bureau file, and there's a so-called Notorious Offenders file, the National Archives, and they contain these records. I went over them with a couple of doctors, and one of the things that we discovered was that Capone had probably contracted the syphilis as a very young man, which I took to mean as a teenager, that it had lain dormant for about 20 years, and as often happens, and then came to the surface and more or less exploded by the time he got to Alcatraz. And this manifested itself in a dementia. It was sort of like having Alzheimer's. And Capone went crazy there after a while and stopped functioning and spent a considerable amount of time in the prison hospital. In fact, spent a considerable amount of time in a almost like a huge cage. He lived like a caged animal for over a year there because he was considered so dangerous. Although actually, once the syphilis began working on his brain, he was far less dangerous than he would have been at any other time. In fact, Capone was never really a dangerous prisoner. He was always very compliant and was often picked on by other prisoners.
Well, your theory is that the dementia caused by syphilis actually was part of the reason why he became a violent man as a gangster.
Yes.
That sounds really revisionist to me.
One of the classic symptoms of syphilis is feelings of megalomania, and also wild or increasingly pronounced mood swings. People who know a victim of syphilis well wouldn't see it because the changes tend to be incremental. But over a period of years, the increments really build up. It seemed to me that if Capone had never had syphilis, he would never have had the huge outbursts that he was known for. For instance, the time when he battered three men nearly to death with a baseball bat just before they were finished off by some assassins.
Is that the story that became the famous scene with De Niro in the recent movie The Untouchables?
Right, that inspired it. That inspired it.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of outbursts would not have happened if he hadn't been suffering from syphilis.
What makes you say that, though? How can you say that?
Well, otherwise, Capone tended to be, he was not a pathological or criminal kind of personality. He was not inherently violent as a young man, and he did not particularly like to use his fists. He was known as a very good dancer. But the syphilis distorted his personality. There's another thing that I should bring up, too, and that was his cocaine addiction, which was something else I discovered from his medical records, which hadn't been generally known before. But Capone had been a very heavy cocaine user when he was in Chicago. The cocaine was easy enough to come by. It was very prevalent in those days. And especially in brothels where he worked, many of the prostitutes there used cocaine. Capone blew a hole in his septum because he snorted so much of it, and that's how the doctors became aware of that.
You know, reading your book, I almost felt like you wanted to like Capone so much. You were finding all these outside reasons to explain his most violent outbursts.
Well, it wasn't so much Capone personally, because there was much about him that was irredeemable or contemptible, but in the book, I was also trying to explore the entire gangster ethos, and it seemed to me that the stereotype of the murderous Southern Italian criminal, which had been a very popular one at the beginning of this century, and which Capone was a major part of, or the Capone legend was a major part of, really didn't have that much basis in fact, and was in many ways outmoded and a damaging stereotype, sort of like Step and Fetch It or Shylock. And I thought it was worth re-examining that because, unlike those other stereotypes, this one still keeps going on today.
When Capone got out of prison, he was your basic washed-up gangster. I guess a crime had passed him by. He was old hat.
That's right.
What had changed while he was in prison?
Well, the repeal, for one thing. And so that was the end of the Jazz Age, the end of Prohibition, and all the money and power that it brought to gangsters like him. Also, his mind was gone. He functioned at a very low level after that and lived in kind of a fog. So he could no longer resume his role in the rackets. And his brothers, some of whom tried to take over or take up the standard that he had thrown down, were not really as capable as Al and couldn't do the same thing. Also, many other racketeers learned a lesson from Capone, and that lesson was to avoid publicity. They felt that more than anything else had been his undoing, and they tended to operate much more in the shadows than Capone did. Capone was addicted to publicity and press conferences, and he loved to know anybody who was powerful, whether it was sports figures or politicians. And his successors were much more careful.
What would Capone do at his press conferences?
Well, he would try and justify himself. He was a good debater, and he would point to the hypocrisy of his accusers, which was true. He would gloss over his own crimes. And, of course, he served booze to the reporters, which immediately got them on his side.
How could he do that? How could he serve booze to them?
Well, he had it there. It was his own booze that he brewed in his own breweries. And
But that makes the reporters complicit.
Well, they were. And I interviewed a number of reporters from that era, and they were happy to drink his booze, to go to his parties, to accept his cigars, tickets to fights that he controlled, almost anything that they attended, parties that he gave at his house in Miami Beach. Almost any kind of largesse that he dispensed, they were happy to receive.
I wonder if writing this book you thought a lot about America's almost love-hate relationship with gangsters. I mean, you know, gangsters kill, gangsters violate the law, and Americans hate them for that, and yet mm-hmm. gangsters become heroes or anti-heroes. Think of how many movies and books have been written mm-hmm. about them. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we need our bad guys. I think it's we need the psychological or imaginative release that they provide. As Mark Twain once said, heaven for climate, hell for company. They're so much more interesting than average people.
I want to thank you a lot for talking about your biography of Al Capone.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lawrence Berggren is the author of Capone, The Man and the Era. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Sue Spolin, with Jewel Bracey and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Daniel Schorr is an NPR news analyst and a former member of Edward R. Murrow's legendary CBS News team. He was covering the Watergate scandal when his name turned up on President Nixon's enemies list. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Schorr. He's hosting a cable documentary series about Watergate. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.